Accession number 10037, reel number 1.
Mr. Jepson, could I ask you about your background? You know, this is before the war started. Were you living in Sussex, for instance?
No. When the war started, I was living in Sidcup, actually. But seeing the war was coming, we put all our furniture into store. My wife went back to Rottingdean and I went back to Rottingdean. And then I went and worked for Radio Rentals at the time as an engineer. And after a few months, I was offered a branch managership at Westcliff on Sea, which I went to. My wife came with me, and I was there for, well, until I got called up as area manager. And of course, that covered the whole period of the Battle of Britain, which was right over our heads practically all the time. So we put up with a lot of bombing and shelling. My wife acted as my secretary there in Westcliff-on-Sea. And many times, all we had was an Anderson shelter around the back. And in the middle of these raids, she would grab the money till, and I would go round, and we would go round into this shelter. And many a time, as we were running round, we had shell cases rattling down on the pavements. And of course, the night raids, we slept practically every night in a shelter down on under Cliff Gardens, which was overlooking the Thames, and we could look right across to Sheerness, and we saw all the bombing and searchlights and shelling, many planes, you know, shot down. That it was quite an experience. And then in October, I got called up, my papers, and I went, and then we came back to Rottingdean, and my wife went back to work, and I went off and went to Cardington, and then on to Morecambe to do my, you know, basic training. And then I went to Cranwell for 8 weeks to make myself familiar with the RAF equipment, you see. Well, then I got posted to Sopley, which is down in Hampshire. And that was on the... They were developing the advanced radar for controlling night flights there. And I was on that until, really, I was then on overseas posting for the whole time. I hadn't been allocated to a particular squadron or section, but I was just kind of floating doing this work. And then I got sent to Honnerley, which I think is not far from Birmingham. And during that period was when my father-in-law died, and I came home on compassionate grounds. And immediately after the funeral, I went back to Honnerley, expecting to be back. We used to get a 48-hour pass away once a fortnight, expecting to be back in a fortnight. But when I got there, the station was in a state of uproar, and everybody was rushing about, and nobody was allowed off the station or to telephone. All the telephone boxes were sealed, and all we were given were tickets to fill in with our army post office number. And the next day I was issued with tropical kit and things, and within I think it was 48 hours we left at 4 o'clock in the morning from that station, and before it even got light, because this was in November.
It's 1941,
isn't it? 1941, yeah, November 1941, early November 1941. We are on the boat, which was the Duchess of Bedford.
Yes, boat. I'd like to ask you a lot more about that, but I wonder if you'd bear with me, if I can go back a bit, to the period just before the war started, because you were telling me some interesting things about the your awareness of international events in the 1930s. Could we go back to this period?
Well, early in the 20s even, my wife, when I first met my wife, she was only 16 and I was 19, but she was quite a strong supporter of the International Friendship League and the World Peace Movement, you know, not as a pacifist, but, you know, endeavouring to, if possible, eliminate war, because we could remember the 1914-18 war quite well, You see, I was seven when that started, so one didn't want that to occur again. And I was, you know, quite, not an ardent supporter, but a supporter of it.
Yes, what was it about World War One that, do you think, you know, made you feel like that?
Well, because during that period, I had a brother, and also I had a sister who was over in Paris during the shelling of Paris, and I had a brother who was in the army. He was in the Army Veterinary Corps, and he was gassed slightly and lost hearing in one ear, and he came back, you know, not a very fit man, and all those kind of things. And then in those times, the deaths were quite, you know, horrific. And even in the small street that I lived in, there must have been quite a number, because, and even after the war, I don't think many people seem to remember this, but lots of individual streets had their own war memorials. And I can remember ours quite easily. It was made of teak, and or one of the hardwoods, and all the names were painted on it. And it used to be opened at, in the morning and closed at night. And they used to put flowers, people, you know, who lived in there. And those memorials were in many streets, and I've never seen or know really what happened to them. Nobody ever seems to mention them. But this happened, and that was in Brighton.
Do you remember also the food shortages?
Oh, terribly so. I can remember on one of them, I could have only been about nine, and you used to get rumours that there were going to be certain things coming in the next day. And on this occasion, I remember getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and going down to form the queue at the Maypole in Lewis Road, Brighton. And the queue, when I got there, extended for about, must have been nearly a quarter of a mile. And gradually I got closer and closer, and I got, just before 9 o'clock, I got within about a dozen from the door, and they put the notice up, sold out. And also, the shortage of coal, because nobody delivered coal. If you wanted coal, you had to go and collect it, and there were no such things as central heating or anything like that. You relied on coal. And I remember having a little barrow and going round to a coal merchant's in Elm Grove and queuing up to get a half a hundredweight of coal on this old Tate sugar box with a pair of pram wheels as to take it home. I mean, everybody had to do it because there was no deliveries of coal, and if you wanted coal, you had to go and fetch it, and things like that. And there was terrible shortages. Meat was practically non-existent because there was no rationing at all in the First World War. You just queued up and got what you could.
So it would seem your image of war was a negative.
It was a pretty grim one. Yes, it was very grim. And not far from me also was the hospital, which had been a workhouse at the top of Elm Grove in Brighton, which I used to see many soldiers, you know, with legs missing and things like that. So it was, well, naturally, one would think that we must eliminate this somehow. And so that's why I was a supporter, more or less, of, as I say, not a pacifist, but a supporter of doing as much as possible to eliminate it.
So you were really anti-war, would you put
it? I was anti-war, yeah, definitely anti-war. And, of course, sports, but as I say, later, when I went to up, I was working in Sidcup and met a man, a friend, and his wife, who happened to be a German. And he had a dual nationality. He was Anglo-American. And I got very friendly with them and my wife. We used to go to tea with them. And then about in the early 30s, I went there in about 1934. And in the 30s, wireless, of course, was more interesting than radio, because there wasn't television then. And my interest was tuning around, finding different stations. And I was always picking up the German station with this ranting and raving going on, not being able to understand it. But having this German girlfriend, she began interpreting for us, and we could hear what he was. And then, of course, I began to have second thoughts when I realised what was going on, and realised then, really, what our lobby had done to England, because England then was very unprepared. We had no planes much, we had nothing. And of course I began to think differently then, when I realised what a great, really damage Hitler could do. which he did do.
Yes, you know, you imply that the atmosphere was quite pacific in the 30s. You were saying about your lobby and the...
Oh, yes, it was a very, very strong anti-war lobby in the 30s, extremely strong, very powerful. And I think they had so much influence on the governments of the time that armament, more or less disarmament, was taking place. If it was disarmament, there was no fresh arms created, which, of course, we thought was... Naturally, at the time, and I think any right person would think, if only everybody would have done it. I was getting a bit late when I realised everybody wasn't doing it.
Can you remember what event it was that sparked off, you know, this change in you? Was there any particular...
No particular, because I used to hear these rantings and ravings 2 and 3 times a week. You see, you tune in and, you know, fiddling about, tuning in the different stations, and you'd hear this... that you began to know the voice directly, you got to it, and I'd stop and I'd listen and all the crowd shouting. And then, of course, as I say, I got my friend to interpret it, what was happening, and slowly I began to realise that we'd perhaps been behaving rather foolishly. Though Ed of the best of intentions.
And did your wife, did she change her opinion?
Oh, I think so, yes, because she was more anti-war than I was originally. It was her that influenced me in the first place, you see. I really wasn't really much interested at 19 in it until you begin to think about things a little.
But could you understand, you know, even though you had altered your attitude towards Hitler, if not to war in general... Could you understand that there were people who still were against a war?
Oh, I think so. I could understand it, because it's an ideal. And I think if you can achieve the ideal, no doubt it's marvellous. But then afterwards you've got to choose the lesser of two evils, what you consider to be the lesser of two evils. And I thought, I didn't really, when I heard this man ranting and raving, I didn't think it was a very good idea at all to be... dominated by him.
What did you feel about conscientious objectors in World War II?
Well, I thought that if they were genuine conscientious objectors, well, they were right to be, as long as they were genuine conscientious objectors. I think most of them were, that were conscientious. I thought they were misguided when I got towards the war. I thought they were misguided, but that's their right.
If you could now take us with the journey to Rangoon from Liverpool.
Well, we were all aroused in the morning about 4 o'clock. Rows of lorries waiting for us, and we were put on the train very early. All the stations were guarded by military police so that nobody could slip away. They even examined all the lavatories to see that nobody had hidden in these. And we went on the train. We eventually got to Liverpool, and it was not light. It must have been about 6 o'clock, and straight onto buses down to the docks and onto the boat. And the boat we went onto was the Duchess of Bedford. And all day long, people were arriving until the boat, to my, seemed to be bursting from the seams. And we were gradually sorted ourselves out, and space we were allocated was right down on D deck, down a narrow companionway, and about 200 of us down there, and it was almost on the waterline. So when I looked around, I thought, well, we're not going to stand much chance if this gets torpedoed. But anyhow, we went out early the following morning, very early. It was a very foggy, misty day, which I suppose was why it had been done during that time of the year. And off we went. When we got out, we met up with about another 30 ships, all together, well out in the Atlantic, and we set off, all going. And as I'd done a little sailing before the war, and a funny thing, I always carried a little compass with me in my pocket. I did it more or less for setting up radio aerials. And I could, well, by the sun, I knew we were zigzagging, and I kept a rough account of more or less the direction we were going in. And it seemed that we were making for America, because nobody knew where we were going, at least we didn't, the ordinary troops. And this seemed to go on for 10 days to a fortnight. And the conditions on the boat were really atrocious. The sanitary arrangements consisted of just a rough wooden trough on the after deck, right across the after deck and well aft, with just hessian round it, and it was just a long communal lavatory, and with salt water being pumped in one side of the trough and running out, I suppose, over the other side. Washing facilities were just salt water showers. They did sell salt water soap at the Naffy, but which wouldn't lather, and of course you just felt sticky and horrible all day. And for ordinary fresh water, the fresh water taps were turned on for 10 minutes in the morning, which we filled our hot water bottles, and half of that we used to keep for the following morning for shaving, because you couldn't possibly shave in salt water unless you wanted a very sore face. And this is how the conditions were. And it began to get hotter and hotter, because apparently we were going south, as we realised, and the conditions down below got atrocious, and there was almost a mini riot. And we got a number of officers down there to inspect, and all the fellas jammed the doorway so that they couldn't get up, and they kept, you know, haranguing them, and until the officers were just soaked in perspiration like we had been. So after this, they decided to allow us to sleep on the decks, providing naturally there was no smoking or talking because of, I suppose, the submarines, which of course was quite sensible. But then we only had two blankets to lay on, which were our issue, and our life jackets we used to use as pillows. And this was, we had to get up at about 4:30 and at 5 in the morning for the crew to come and hose the decks down, so we didn't get. And then we spent the day wandering around the decks as much as you could, because you had to step over people sitting around all the time. You couldn't really walk anywhere. And in every corner there was usually a sergeant running a game of housey-housey, pocketing the profits. And if you could find a corner, there were a number of paperback books that were kind of passed around. They were pretty, you know, ratty, but you used to find an odd corner if you could get out of the noise of these housey-housey, as they called it, games, and read. Well, this went on for a considerable time, and it seemed as though, you know, we were seemed to be hanging about all over the place. And then suddenly one morning we came into what I afterwards discovered was Freetown, and it was a marvellous sight. It is a marvellous sight from the sea, to see Freetown, all the jungle, and it's so green, it seemed, right down. But they were, naturally, we weren't allowed ashore. We anchored about a mile off for a few days while they rewatered the ship and took on certain provisions. And we would just spend our day looking over the side, watching all these little boats coming out selling things, you know, bananas and coconuts. And then early one morning we were off again. And this went on almost for another week or so, and conditions were still pretty grim on the boat. And after we'd left Freetown, taking on water, everybody seemed to develop dysentery. I suppose it was a change in water. And conditions on the boat were atrocious. They were, you know. And then to add to it, for about 4 days we ran into some very, very heavy seas. And I should think 80% of the people on the troop ship were, you know, seasick. And the smell through that ship and that was simply shocking. And it was a bonus to me, because I'd done a lot of boating and sailing, so my sea legs weren't too bad. And I can always remember I went down to breakfast one morning, and the one thing on the boat we used to get was bread. They used to bake all their own bread. And we used to have lovely rolls in the morning baked in the ship's bakery. And also that morning they had kippers. And honestly, I must have eaten three or four pair of kippers for breakfast rolls, because there was only four of us went down to breakfast, and there were these trays and trays of kippers. I've always remembered that. Of course, most of them all went over the side because of this. Who was so, the men were so sick and couldn't face breakfast. This went on for about 2 or 3 days.
What's morale like, you know, after all that?
Pretty grim. It was pretty grim. The chaps were pretty, well, naturally, leaving home, not knowing where you're going, and the conditions under which you are living, you can't imagine that morale is ever, you know, it wouldn't under that be good. But anyhow, eventually we went into Durban, and then things did seem to brighten up because we had we were allowed ashore, and the people were extremely hospitable, and they had marvellous clubs there with all beautiful fresh fruit and everything. And I went out with a trip on a coach trip. I went out and to the Valley of a Thousand Hills, which is the Zulu places, which I found very interesting. There were so many interesting things to say. Well, this was about 4 days before Christmas, about the 20th, I think, I'm guessing, of December. And of course, everybody, most of the chaps had been invited out for to Christmas Day, because, as I say, the people were very hospitable, so they all got invited. But this wasn't to be, because I think it was Christmas Eve. We woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock to find that we were putting to sea. So we never got our Christmas in South Africa.
This would have been, am I right in thinking you would have been on the water when Pearl Harbor?
Yes, okay. This is what the trouble, Pearl Harbor had occurred. We heard it over the radio, but we didn't know a lot about it because we didn't get much news, you see. We heard practically nothing. We knew that the Japanese had attacked an American base, but that's all we did know. We learnt a bit more when we got to South Africa, and we all came to the... Well, then, when we left Durban, and we knew, realised that then we were more or less heading for the Far East, whereas we all anticipated that we were, which I think we were originally intended to go, be sent to the Middle East, to North Africa. But even though I was considered myself extremely lucky, because I think half the convoy were sent to Singapore and went straight into the Japs' hands, whereas we were the more fortunate ones that we were diverted to, eventually, to Rangoon. And then we arrived at Bombay from Durban, straight onto trains, and those trains, troop trains in those days, were pretty grim. They were consisted of wooden slats and wooden slatted backs, and we were allocated 8 to a carriage, and you hook the backs up to make beds so that you lay kind of head to feet, so 2 above and 2 below each side, so it's 8 of you to a carriage. And then there's a corridor, with just right at the end of the corridor there was one lavatory, and then we started off on this trip across India, which the food was terrible. All we had was what they, I think they call hard tack, like dog biscuits in tins, and we had some cans of butter, and then they used to make tea in a big billy can and put tea in and carnation and take it up to the engine to get the boiling water out of the engine when we stopped to make a big billy can, and we existed on that for 5 days right across until we got to Calcutta. Then they had some marquees in on the Maidan, you know, the big open place in the middle of Calcutta, where the ladies of Calcutta had got a few sandwiches and things and hard-boiled eggs and that, which we... It was the first... Well, I suppose it was the first real feed we'd had for days. And then on to more small boats down the Hooghly till we got to another troop ship called the Neuralia. And we had... This was pretty grim. We to get up... they went alongside and they had climbing nets, which we had to struggle up with 2 kit bags, a rifle, and everything else. It was pretty, you know, grim. It wasn't. And we eventually got on board, and this was the Neuralia, which I believe was a proper troop ship for the eastern parts. And then down towards, getting towards the mouth of the Hooghly, we ran aground, and we were stuck there for another 24 hours till they got it off. But I think this is quite common, because I think they have a lot of moving sandbanks and things down there. And eventually, it took us about a day and a half, 2 days, we arrived down through the Bay of Bengal. We arrived at Rangoon, right in the middle of an air raid. They were bombing the mostly the harbour and lorries, and on these lorries out to Mingledon Airfield, which was about 12 miles north of Rangoon, which was the last airfield.
Yeah. What date was it when you arrived? Can you remember?
Yes, it would have been about early in January, either the first or second, somewhere about the end, because I've calculated from when we left Durban just before Christmas and the time that it took us. So it would have been early January 1942.
Mm. Well, can you remember your response, you know, to learning that we were at war with the Japanese? Were you surprised about that?
Well, we were, because honestly, I hadn't considered Japan as a likely, contender in the war at all. I knew they were in China and had been, occupying parts of China for a number of years, but I didn't think that they would go in and take on America and England, and it did come as a surprise. Mm.
Can you remember when you went into Rangoon, your first impressions of what was going on, the situation there?
Well, there did seem a fair amount of panic, but we didn't really have long to observe it much, because we only got on lorries in the docks and were driven straight out. And it was, as I say, there were bombings were going on at the time. And when we got to the airfield and got into the airfield, we found that all the buildings had been bombed, all the billets, even the cookhouse had gone. So we were then just getting our food from field kitchens, which mainly consisted of rice, boiled rice, and anything they could, cook up. The food was pretty grim again. But eventually they found a convent school down at Insin, which is a village about 2 to 3 miles away from Mengla Don, a convent school that had been evacuated, all the people had been evacuated, and so we were placed in their dormitories.
Could I ask you now, which squadron were you with?
Well, I was on 135 squadron.
And could you tell me what other RAF squadrons were there?
There were 17 squadron. The only, because they came out with us as well, 17 squadron and 135. And then a nucleus of a headquarters staff. They all came out with us. So I think prior to us getting there were very few RAF personnel, as far as I know.
Sounds very thin defence.
Very well, practically negligible. The only planes I saw that were there were, I saw an old Lysander and one or two small biplanes, but that's all I actually saw. And of course, we had no planes with us whatever. We had a bit of base equipment. I mean, they were, I suppose, were supposed to follow later. But that's all we had there.
So now you are at Insin. You went to Insin.
Well, yes, we were billeted there, but though we were working on the Mengla Don airfield.
Yeah. And would you have been, you would have had billets in the school?
Yes, we had used the dormitories of the school.
Up until then, what had you used for billets?
Well, we had bow tents. We were, actually, when we, for the first few days, we were taken out into a satellite airfield right out in the jungle, because the few planes that were on the airfield there used to fly out to this satellite airfield at night, because the Japs used to come in every night and just plaster the airfield with bombs, practically 3 raids a night. They'd come about, every hour or so, and of course, and there was no defence whatever. There were no AK-AK guns or naturally no night fighters, because we didn't even have day fighters, let alone night fighters. And so we went out there, and then we stopped there for about a week. But the Japs eventually discovered the airfield and bombed it, and we were then living under in tents. But they hit the petrol fuel dump, and so that, which was all stored in the jungle in 40-gallon drums. I think they're about 40-gallon drums, and some had set on fire. And we were sent out to try and save as many of the drums as we could. And there were all the Air Force chaps with long bamboo poles, because you couldn't get near because they were on fire, some of them were on fire, pushing these drums to get them away. It was very lucky that, one or two chaps, they got killed, actually, at the guard. But we were sent out to shift them, were fortunate. I think one or two chaps got a bit burnt, but nothing really serious. But the worst thing was that when they bombed, especially at night, it frightened me more than anything, we had little slit trenches dug. And I was more frightened of the scorpions than what snakes are in the slit. If you dive in there in the dark, probably it was irrational, but that was my biggest fear. I was more frightened of snakes, I think, than the bombers myself.